Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Easily Entertained. I am your host, Maddie McLean, and I wanted to start out today with a little bit of this. ASMR, but really this is, it's already been a week and it's Tuesday, so cheers, motherfuckers. Hello, homies, and welcome to another episode of Easily Entertained. It is so good to be sitting back down here with you guys for another week and run down more shenanigans, crazy things that are happening in this simulation, real world. Yeah, but really, crazy shit's happening left and right. But I'm here to guide you through those seas. And today we'll be talking about quite a few mishmash hodgepodge of things, including new releases, whether that's music, movies, or TV shows, so that I can help you out a little bit if you're stumped on what to watch next or you simply want to hear what's going on. And then we will jump into Alec Baldwin's latest updates in the involuntary manslaughter charges that were previously dismissed against him that are now potentially making their way back to him from the same prosecutors. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And I'm also not sure I said prosecutors, had the wrong emphasis on the incorrect syllable. And then we will discuss a little bit about Britney Spears' latest memoir, The Woman in Me, and some of the biggest takeaways that readers have gleaned so far. I will be purchasing this book and can do a little bit of a book club-esque kind of recap of her memoir, if that's of interest. So I will do a little poll on Instagram at Easily Entertained Pod to see if that's what the majority of people are interested in hearing or not, because if you don't care, then neither do I. But really though, yeah. So we'll start to dip our toes into that because it seems like it's already deep and murky and a lot going on within the confines of this book. So I hope you guys are ready for a ride, baby. Woo! That new. Let's start it out with what is the latest on the scene. The part where I tell you the newish and or upcoming bits of pop culture in the form of TV series, music, movies, books, the works. And today I have a few... And today I have a few singles for your pleasure, as well as some new shit to stream so you don't end up spending an ungodly amount of time scrolling and swiping through literally all of the streaming services apps on your TV, only to then choose a show that you're mildly interested in and have that run in the background while you scroll your phone on Instagram, social media, anything else to just really jam as much dopamine and content into your brain as possible. I'm sorry, is that just me? Anyways, I'm personally such a victim of analysis paralysis these days, but it's something that I'm working on. I'm at least, you know, I think I'll put together a strategy to attack it, or maybe I can talk about on the... Got you there. Oh, that's me just being a silly goose about analysis paralysis. Anywho, so about that new shit that's on the scene, LPGOB, who is one of my very favorite DJs and producers, she just dropped a fire. Yes, I said it. Oh, that's so cringy. But she just dropped a really good remix of Taylor Swift's Cruel Summer. And it's like, you know, just like most of her tracks, it hit real good. I describe her sound as like a vibey chill house with a lot of kind of beats that you could either take to the club, like you're sipping on a martini or something, like a Cosmo maybe, just vibing. Or it could also be like you're one of those more down-to-earth girlies. can't relate. Just that could listen to this while you're, I don't know, tending the garden and going on hikes and stuff. Anyways, but really how she would describe it is femme house. So very girly, feminine kind of house music. And well, if that's how she describes it, let's go with that. It's a lot better. You may recognize her from songs like All in a Dream or Forever in a Day. Forever and a day. All in a dream. Yeah, so that's my singing and as much as you'll get out of me. But she is a DJ and producer from Oregon. And she's actually hit it really big in places like London and Melbourne and Sydney in Australia. But she's also, I feel like, taken the US by storm a little bit more these days. She is incredibly talented. And what I really like about her is that part of her kind of MO is to help change the fact that the stat, and this is shared in her bio from Insomniac Records, which I will link. And actually, you know what? I will just read because I feel like it's a way better description than I can give you myself. Okay. She is a DJ, producer, pianist, and activist who is quickly rising to superstar status. La da 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 da. She emerged in the dance scene in 2018, and she is seen as a one-woman jam band. And she blends her decks with her live piano plus sampler at high-profile festivals, including Coachella, EDC, Lolla, Bonnaroo, Tomorrowland, all of them. And she supported artists like Diplo, DJ Tennis, Sophie Tucker, all of these peeps. But she doesn't need those other names because she is incredible. And she's provided tons of females with access to production workshops, online courses, and scholarship programs through her nonprofit, Femme House. So that's pretty fucking cool. She very recently, too, did a remix of Jerry Garcia's first album, so Jerry Garcia of Grateful Dead, which then led me down this deep, dark rabbit hole, learning more and more about Deadheads. And Grateful Dead is the jam band that began all jam bands. Some people describe them as rock and roll, but like, I don't know. That's not what I wouldn't think Grateful Dead rock and roll, but definitely bluesy rock, I guess. I don't know. Tomato, tomato, I guess that's all getting into semantics. But if you have not heard of Grateful Dead, don't ever tell anyone that and keep it to yourself and just nod and say, of course I know Grateful Dead. And then if they ask you to name five songs, they're an asshole, fuck them and leave them. That's my opinion. Yeah, I got like the Who shirt from from the Melrose, like vintage markets, whatever, and paid way too much money for it, but it's super sick. And it's an original from the Who's tour. And every time I put it on, I re-Google, like I know the Who. I couldn't necessarily name off the top of my head, like 10 songs or whatever. So anytime I put that on, I literally Google, just so I have some top of mind to say that I listen to. Like The Wizard. Anyways, things are derailing quickly, but I then went down that line of thinking into Grateful Dead. And Grateful Dead has had one of the coolest fans and just culture around their live music of all time. And they had, so no one show was ever the same because they would jam. They would switch up the order of the songs, play different songs. And they were most popular at the height of their career, mid-70s to 80s through 90s. They've been around. Jerry Garcia, unfortunately, died back in 1995. So, like, this has been a hot minute. But they have, like, kind of revival bands, Dead and Company, that will put this on. Because Deadheads, the name for Grateful Dead fans, basically follow them around from concert to concert because they were all so different and, like, I don't know, kind of like people chasing stamps on their passport kind of shit. But They even had sections like roped off at their concerts for people to record them. I have never been to a Dead & Company concert, but this Dead & Company is formed of former bandmates of Grateful Dead, plus other artists and musicians, including John Mayer, but they may have stopped touring, I believe. So now that's not even an option. But all to say that Deadhead culture is very much still alive and well. And we got there from LPGOB. So just GOB, she's tight. She's great. We love her. Another personal fave of mine, Kid Cudi, released a new single called Ill What I Bleed. Ill What I Bleed. In all caps. You know, it got me thinking, Carrie Bradshaw style. Do we think that as artists, they have just somebody who's dedicated to working on song title strategy or something like that? You know, because I feel like lately there's been more of an influx these days of a little bit of capitalization creativity, you might say. The worst is when they just alternate or they have no pattern whatsoever. It's like capitalized, lowercase, and it like breaks my brain to look at those song titles, you know? And I think that there is ultimately a reason being that now with streaming and Spotify and however we listen to it now, there's just a whole lot less focus on like album artwork and stuff. That's kind of, you don't see that as much, or it's not made to be as prominent as in the days when you bought like a CD album, like physical CDs. You remember the days? Do you remember the days? Any Gen Zers in the crowd that are real? Would Gen Z be that young? I don't know. I'm a cusper, but so I really straddle that line a little bit. But anyways, I do feel like the artists or musicians that use all caps versus the artists that use all lower caps are like two different types of people, right? Okay, so let's just paint a picture, shall we? Let's start with the all caps person. To me, they're like a Kanye before he got super like irreparably problematic. You know, the class clown, the one who claps in between their words or with the words. We write it out. It's like, know thyself. But I don't think that's, I think it's know thy. Anyways, I'm going to quit clapping in your ear. That's going to be a mess to edit out. But yeah, the all caps person is that person whose contribution, you know, to the conversation sounds like they're aiming for a mic drop after each sentence. You know, kind of like what I'm doing now, when in reality, everyone is just waiting them to hurry the fuck up so that we can move on and like actually talk about what we're talking about, you know, just kind of like pop in there with an opinion. That to me is the all caps person or artist. Sorry, Kid Cudi. You might be somewhat like that. I don't know. But then I think the other draw up, if we have the lowercase person, this is to me, the Timothy Chalamet, the MGK, who's like very endearingly anxious during like PR interviews or press interviews or whatever. It's really sweet. Whose contribution to the conversation instead is more, well, there either isn't one or it's demure. Like what they say is like, they're trying to act like they didn't think really hard about what they're about to say that comes out of their mouth, but they did. Or like they have so many emotions and feelings and they don't like go here type of energy. Alternatively, you know, you have someone like Ariana Grande who is trying really hard to prove that they're chill in a very unchill way. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Maybe you don't know what I mean, but that's how I picture the lowercase and the all caps personalities being different. And then forget the ones that are mixed lowercase, uppercase, lowercase, lowercase, uppercase. They're mentally disturbed. So, you know, pick your poison. Or you could just capitalize as we were taught in school. But yeah, it's a creative field. So I won't allow my grammar preferences to really turn me into a Karen or anything like that. As for movies and TV series for you to stream, there are a few new ones out there that may be worth your time. One being No Hard Feelings with Jennifer Lawrence is the star of that movie, No Hard Feelings. It's really good. It's a feel-good, funny, I want to say rom-com, but really it's just kind of more of a comedy with like romance aspects in there. The general idea of the movie being that there is a job posting that goes out for the son of helicopter parents that want to pay somebody to date him and be his girlfriend. And that's how it all ensues. And it's very good. It's one of those, I just feel like there's tons of action and intense movies and TV shows lately. Obviously, I'm talking about a lot of reality, so not necessarily that, but there are a lot of action and horror movies and just intense, like 3-hour long anthologies out. So it's nice to have a good little palate cleanser to wash away the intensity of the normalcy of the movies we've been seeing. But it's very funny. You can watch that on Netflix. It was out in theaters not too long ago, and so it's just kind of new to Netflix. And another one would be American Horror Story. The 12th season is out, called Delicate. And this is the one that has Kim Kardashian in it. She is, I mean, she's a supporting actress, so it's not like she's central to it, but Emma Roberts is. And I think there's one more person who makes an appearance that I can't think of right now, but it's essentially based around like pregnancy. Emma Roberts is pregnant and she's worried that there is something out there, somebody out there that does not want her to have her baby or keep her baby or something. I don't know. Spooky. And it is spooky season, so spook about. Another spooky TV show is House of Villains. That is on E! And truthfully, full disclosure, I have not yet watched this, but currently there are 2 episodes out, and I'll do us all a favor and I'll watch them. But new episodes are coming out every Thursday. That's Batch Nation Thursday night. So, but nobody watches everything like live anymore. That day is long gone. Even though in the trailer for House of Villains, it says set your DVR. And we still say that in trailers and promos for shows. And I think, we're still saying that? Like, that feels old. It feels really aged out, but who am I to say that? So, basically the whole concept of House of Villains is they've gathered reality TV show infamous villains, from Jax from Vanderpump Rules to a Survivor villain to The Apprentice. Omarosa is on there, to Johnny Bananas from MTV's The Challenge, Corinne Olympios from The Bachelorette, or Bachelor, rather. I love crossovers, and it looks very funny. It's basically, I like that they're really pulling on the fact that we already have, you know, we're already aware that there are villains in every show, and there's got to be one, so I like that they're leaning into that a wee bit. But in the promo too, we saw appearances. Don't know what their involvement in the show will be. Is Carol Baskin. Uh-huh. Dance Moms, Abby Lee Miller too. So that's great. They really nailed some of the most infamous villains out there. I'm sure if they have another season that, like, I don't think the villains will be as villainy, because it seems like they got a good villainous crew, but they essentially all live together in one house and vote each other out, like Big Brother style of the house. And I'm sure, I'm not entirely sure, someone gets the power after winning these games, or they have these competitions. And Oh no, it looks great. So I will take a peek for you, but just know I have not yet seen that one either. So those are things that are new and out and something for you to look out for. And now we have some just kind of more newsy updates and some stories for you. Alec Baldwin was charged with involuntary manslaughter, but those charges were dropped in April of this year. But now the latest in this trial or in the legality of Alec Baldwin's Rust shooting that left someone dead, they're now, prosecutors are bringing it back to a grand jury to potentially, or to, for them to make the decision if they should revisit the charges. This comes after new evidence that kind of contradicts the prosecutor's entire reasoning for dropping the charges. So they feel inclined and to bring it back to a grand jury, where that's where we don't see the jury, it's blind, but they decide if Alec Baldwin should be charged with it versus how it originally was brought into the courts was through a, just closed with the judge. I think a preliminary hearing. If you aren't sure what I'm talking about exactly, in October 2021, Alec Baldwin was producing and acting in his own, quote, low-budget Western film in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Low-budget Western film just sounds like a diss from the get-go, but that's what it was. Anyway, when he actually fatally shot the movie's cinematographer, Helena Hutchins. He also injured Joel Souza, who was the film's director, after the bullet hit the cinematographer, Helena Hutchins, fatally killing her. It then went hit him as well and injured him badly, but he was able to recover. Really tragic, really horrific. There should have never been any live, real ammunition in these guns on set. And no one knows where that came from. It just is never, A, ammunition and real bullets are never, should never be on, near, or around a set. But unfortunately and horrifically, there was one, and that's the one that Alec Baldwin was holding as he was practicing a scene in this kind of small, shoddy church set that they had there in Santa Fe. Investigators are still looking into how this live ammunition made it onto the set. That's still unclear. But after that happened, they took Alec Baldwin, everyone that was working there, the producers, everything on the movie Rust, and interviewed them, got them back to the station. Unfortunately, it was revealed that Helena died from the injuries that she sustained in the shooting. And typically what goes down in movies is that there is an armorer, which is just a really hard word to say. That means the person who is certified and is trained in handling firearms. So usually movies have an armorer that will hand off the gun to whoever is acting with the gun in the movie set. There's never live bullets. But what they do is they triple check that. They check all the chambers or whatever, supposedly where they are, and make sure that everything looks good. There's no obstructions. And then they yell out cold, cold, as in it's not hot with a bullet, before they hand it over to the actor who's using that as a prop. So there was an armorer, and she was a young 24-year-old named Hannah Gutierrez Reed, who was hired by Rust, other producer, not Alec Baldwin, supposedly. And already in this, because it's a low-budget film, you know, a lot of actors, producers, behind the scenes, cinematographers, what have you, are doing, you know, multiple jobs. And so was Hannah at the time. So, I mean, her lawyers are saying that she was stretched thin as it was. But then there was also a kind of second person checking it, Dave Halls, who was the first assistant producer who would inspect it. And they went through he said that they went through the safety protocol, but he unfortunately did not check every chamber as he should have. So after all the police have talked to everybody, getting the hold on the situation, Dave Halls, that first assistant producer, Hannah Gutierrez Reed, the armorer, and Alec Baldwin himself, who was holding the gun, all are charged with involuntary manslaughter. They go through the prosecution, and eventually the charges are dropped against Alec Baldwin. Charges are still on for Hannah Gutierrez Reed, and Dave Halls had taken a plea deal. But before we jump to the charges being dropped, while this was going on, already the prosecutors were having a hard time. Alec Baldwin's defense was putting up a good defense, as, you know, someone with the money like Alec Baldwin has is probably able to do. But something just fishy was kind of going on already with the production of Rust, because the night before, six photographers and videographers actually quit all at the same time, but what they had originally cited was due to poor hotel, like, living situations, and only then later did they cite safety concerns. Apparently there had been two misfires before, but that wasn't ever confirmed, I guess, or unclear. But clearly, you know, where there's there's smoke, there's fire, but sounds a little bit, I don't mean it, no pun intended. Anyways, I just, all to say, if that's happening in this production of the movie already, and then this goes down, that's kind of scary. And the debate is super interesting to me and a little convoluted. Probably one of the most gray things is because in that circumstance, who is responsible for the tragic death of Helena? You know, the person holding the gun, but is the actor responsible in checking to make sure that there is no live ammunition when they're not a gun specialist and they have a hired gun specialist? Clearly, as you could probably tell by the way I'm describing it, I'm more apt to think that it's a horrifying, horrible accident on the part of Alec Baldwin. Yes, he was holding the gun, but he didn't know that there was live ammunition. Now, the prosecutors are saying that he pulled the trigger, and I guess that's something you're not supposed to do. He says he didn't. And it really becomes this kind of semantic, legal word salad mishmash of, did he pull the trigger or not? Really, he says he's pulled the hammer. I had to look this up. You pull the hammer before the trigger, and he says he pulls the hammer, not the trigger. And essentially, they didn't have enough time, the prosecutors, so they dropped the charges. But they were saying that they still had the intention, if they could, to refile after they sent it in for secondary analysis. It looked like the gun had been modified. Essentially, Alec Baldwin must have pulled trigger, or else it wouldn't have been possible. I laughed because I'm struggling to. I do not know guns very well. Sorry. All of that went down, and now that they've found conflicting evidence based on the secondary gun analysis, they are bringing the charges back. There's also an interesting charge that was brought again to Hannah Gutierrez Reed, the armorer, for evidence tampering, for apparently, this is very bizarre, for apparently handing off a baggie of Coke and not the soda kind, like, off to a coworker after her police interview to avoid, you know, getting that found on her, I guess because she knew that they were going to look into her. But then that's like all they leave at. You know, they don't even try and go into how that would be connected necessarily. I mean, well, if she was doing it on, you know, if she's on drugs and she's handling guns on set, that could make sense as to why that's involved. But if it was a thing of selling it, I don't know. I watch so much true crime that I'm, you know, playing good old devil's advocate, as everyone hates a devil's advocate. Anyways, even still, So that's where we're left off. We'll see what happens next with Alec. I watched, he did an interview with ABC like 2 months after the terrible accident happened and she had died. And it was just, I don't know. He's very hard to be likable, even though I feel like he didn't do it. It wasn't on purpose. It wasn't intentional. And I don't really know if he should be charged with anything. I think the armorist and the first producer who are held responsible in handling it, yes. But he's just not likable. Not ever since that horrible voicemail. So his past was he was the one who sent this terrible voicemail that was leaked to the press. To his daughter, where he was like screaming and ranting. And this was a long time ago. Like, if that happened today, he would be long canceled. And he kind of was, but he's back. Something to look out for. We shall see. They did resume filming of Rust, but in Montana and no longer New Mexico for kind of obvious reasons. Something kind of sweet that comes out of that is actually Helena Hutchins' widowed husband, Matthew Hutchins, came back on when they restarted filming as an executive producer. But we'll see what happens through that. Yeah. We shall see. And then lastly, we will touch on, because there is so much to unpack in Britney Spears' new memoir, The Woman in Me. We're just going to talk about as it relates to her ex, Justin Timberlake. I almost said Justin Bieber. I feel like Justin Bieber and Britney Spears probably would have a lot in common, you know, as being child stars and being kind of mistreated on both cases by the media and the press. But anywho, that's not the point. I will start off by sharing a little bit about the memoir, because there's so much going on with the conservatorship and the backstory on that and all that Britney Spears went through and kind of the theories there, that we could dedicate a whole episode to that. And that is something we can do if we want to do a little Britney deep dive. There's so many documentaries, so many memoirs and all of that good stuff that are out there now. So I don't know. You could be sick of hearing about it. So I'll ask on Instagram again about that and see if that's something of interest to do. But in her memoir that actually released on Tuesday, October 24th, which is today as I'm recording, but I haven't gotten the chance to read this. So I will be relying on a Today article. And I will link this in the show notes, of course, because this article is talking about everything that she says about Justin Timberlake in her memoir, starting with meeting him. You know, they met in Mickey Mouse Club. They're both super, super young. And they kind of, Britney says she was just madly in love from the get-go, as teens in love are. It wasn't until later after they met when later in their career, she's early in her singing career, and Justin Timberlake had just joined NSYNC and started dating. This was back in 1999 to about 2002 was their 3-year relationship. And obviously the press back then, whole different kind of mammal then too. So they're never very nice. And in the documentary, I need to double check where this is, but it's called Framing Britney Spears. And it's all about Justin Timberlake's and the media and kind of everybody else's just complete shattering of her. And in part of that documentary, talking about how Justin Timberlake had just come out with Cry Me a River, and the way he shaped it to everybody was that they broke up because Britney had cheated on him. In reality, that was not the case. As many toxic men do, he projected. And he was the one who was cheating on her allegedly all the time. And she put up with it and knew about it because she was so in love with him. And she does clarify too, though, she did make out with somebody and they had made up over that and whatever. And he never mentioned or never came clean really about him cheating on her, even though it was confirmed, like this British girl band called All Saints, that somebody, a photographer, taking photos of that and all of this, but she was still painted as the bad guy. It's kind of something she talks about in her memoir. And sadly, we do get the shocking revelation that she was pregnant with Timberlake's child. I believe she was 19 and he was 20, and she would have kept the baby, but sadly she ended up getting an abortion, really just because Timberlake wasn't ready to be a dad, and she feels like she wouldn't have done that. Justin Timberlake broke up with her over text message and ended things while they were both filming separate music videos. And then later, supposedly he came to visit her while she was in Louisiana after they broke up and had framed a breakup letter to her and then given it to her, and then he left and that was it. So that's weird. Don't like that at all. Not to mention my personal favorite little factoid is she mentions that when they have sex that she asked, "Did you put it in?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "Oh, and my world collapsed." That's the dish on Justin Timberlake. There's obviously a lot more deep things that go on about the treatment of her family and the conservatorship and all of that, but thought we'd start with the juicy things. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. As always, I would love it if you left a rating or a review on any of the podcast streaming platforms or Apple Podcasts mainly. And then look out for any polls and such. I would love to get your input, and reach out to me on Instagram at easilyentertainedpod. And we'll be getting some guests on too. So if you have any desires in your brain, let me know. Have a great rest of your week, and we'll talk next week. Love ya. Bye, homies.